I would just like to begin by pointing out that, if I remember, Maestri played on the Athletics when Lou Bordeaux was the manager. I think it's a very, very useful piece of trivia. What I would like to speak on tonight is, or at least the theme of my remarks, is the modernization, a tendentious term. I have been told to confine my remarks to 15 minutes at the most, and if at the end of 15 minutes I'm still somewhere in the middle of my manuscript, please feel free to make noise, interrupt me. The success of this program depends upon my willingness to relinquish this place at the end of 15 minutes. The problem of modernization reflects a peculiarly modern concern. To most ancient thinkers, it would have seemed incomprehensible that one should be occupied with or advocate a reconstruction of basic human relationships without even a fixed view of human nature. The teachings of Socrates in Plato's Republic, which might be cited as a case to the contrary, confirms the difference between ancient and modern thought. For Socrates and for Plato, the universe and the human mind contained eternal forms. Socrates tried to demonstrate and even announces in the Republic, Book 9, that the quest for ideal justice can be fulfilled in heaven but not in human society. His specific proposals in the middle books for eugenics, female emancipation, communal living, were intended to shock, and according to Leo Strauss and Paul Friedlander, demonstrate his sense of irony far more than his reforming zeal. In the main, Greek and Roman political thought was sympathetic to ancestral custom. Indicative of the Greek reverence for custom is the speech that Aeschylus, in the popular play The Eumenides, puts into the mouth of the city's patron goddess. Pleading for Orestes before Athens' city fathers, Pallas Athena invokes an idealized future. Here, piety and the innate reverence of our citizens not to act unjustly will prevail by day and by night. Citizens will never innovate upon established laws. Athenians will avert evil by embracing reverence as the defense of their land and the very salvation of their city. Such filial pietism may have come naturally to those who viewed history as following a cyclical or circular pattern. The classical understanding of historical time gave no grounds for the optimism about human improvability associated with modernization. Ancient historians wrote about the founding of cities, the waging of wars, and the establishment of hegemony. Nonetheless, they could not have anticipated Hegel, Marx, and Arthur Schlesinger by depicting the stages in mankind's movement towards steadily higher levels of social existence. The notion of modernization first achieves widespread significance during the Enlightenment. The French philosopher and mathematician, the Marquis de Condorcet, sketched in the 1790s an outline for a self-perfecting history that culminates in the age at whose threshold he believed himself to be standing. Condorcet linked this final epoch to the eradication of traditional religion and to the triumph of scientific method. This linkage was paradigmatic for almost all future attempts to define modernization. The French scholar Émile Durkheim, lecturing on socialism in the 1890s, recognized the fundamental principle of the new social movement was the belief in a centralized organization of production, a centrally planned economy. But as Max Weber, perhaps a much wiser man, pointed out, the thrust of economic modernization was not only toward a nationalized economy and welfare state, but toward an absolute demystification of the world and an absolute secularization of authority. Weber's conception of modernization was always distinguished by a remarkable sensitivity to the losses this process entailed. He saw explosive conflicts within modernity itself that would render the future far less than a paradisical age. Weber distinguished at least two distinct phases of cultural modernization, what some, particularly the man who introduced me, George Nash, in a very eloquent address at Hillsdale in February, spoke of as modernity and postmodernity. The former designates, or actually I think George spoke of modernity, the two modernities, early and late modernity. The former designates a way of life that is still relatively close to Protestant traditions. It seeks to wed economic freedom with moral responsibility and material progress with religious social constraint. Weber himself admired the synthesis and often praised that form of modernity which he associated with his own Calvinist merchant ancestors. Yet he realized how transitional that culture was. The rationality and economic productivity that grew out of the Protestant capitalist world would help to destroy both freedom and the work ethic. The wresting of nature's abundance would awaken the hope and finally demand that material benefits be made available to all members of society. The established relationship between capitalism and popular government would work to each one's disadvantage. The people would abandon liberty for security and yield power to bureaucrats. Weber's persistent fear was that the Western future would contain neither dignity nor freedom. It would leave the sensitive and scholarly, in his words, trapped in the iron cage of bureaucracy, manipulated by faceless managers in a world emptied of transcendent meaning. I presented these Weberian themes, admittedly with broad strokes, for two reasons. First, it should be stressed that Weber saw that modernization involves cultural breakdown as well as material gain. He also recognized a threatening and paradoxical tendency in modernization. An enterprise that initially advanced human freedom and creativity might ultimately reduce mankind to self-imposed slavery. No wonder that Herbert Marcuse, one of my former teachers, repeatedly denounced Weber as a very dangerous reactionary. Weber was critical not only of Marx's materialist historical interpretation, but of the prospect of a post-capitalist and collectivist modernity, precisely what Marcuse believed in. And finally, Weber warned academics against the confounding of scholarship and ideology. His admonitions about this would apply not only to a proto-New Leftist like Marcuse, but generally to interpreters of modernization who advocate rather than analyze what they purport to describe. They project into the future their own subjectivist dreams, which they proclaim as a scientific axiom, moral imperative, or sometimes as both. In the late 50s, Karl Deutsch, among other prominent political scientists, predicted the impending disappearance of Soviet dictatorship. On this theory, Soviet Russia had already entered upon modernization that would result, quote, in an open society and spiritual pluralism, unquote. Despite its naive and fanciful size, the theory mentioned does have one merit, though perhaps a debatable one. It is an invitation to inactivity, particularly in military matters, which may, one hopes, be spurned by those who see the Soviet Union accurately. The most unsettling views of modernization, however, are those presented in favor of behavioral modification, particularly when their exponents would use political coercion to reach desired goals. Two works which typify the second tendency are Amitai Etzioni's The Active Society and Rolf Dahrendorf's Society and Democracy in Germany. Both authors, but especially Etzioni, turn an allegedly scholarly discussion of modernization into a point of departure for their private political dreams. Etzioni prefaces his study of what he calls postmodern society with this assertion. The modern period ended with the radical transformation of communications, knowledge, and energy that followed World War II. The efficacy of technology of production poses a growing challenge to the primacy of the values these means are supposed to serve. The postmodern period, the onset of which may be set in 1945, will witness either a greater threat to the status of these values by the surging technologies or a reassertion of their normative priorities. It is never made clear why Etzioni chooses 1945 as opposed to 1935 or 1955 or 1455 as the watershed between modernity and postmodernity. Whatever the reasons for this division, it may in fact be less arbitrary than his judgments about modernization. He reiterates that the power of surging technologies has driven us to a crossroads. No society, quote, has escaped the impact of new technologies, unquote. The only active response he considers appropriate to this change, quote, is a reasserting of values illustrated by the civil rights movement in the United States, decolonization and modernization drives in new nations and transnational social movements. Unfortunately, one is never quite sure what surging technologies have been overwhelming us since 1945, or what values in particular Etzioni desires to salvage by mobilizing us politically. When he does express moral judgments, the positive predicates are open, autonomous, and active. I counted in his book the use, well, I would say it was repeated use of these terms. They appeared hundreds of times. in the course of his work on postmodern society, which I think was atop the bestseller list for a very short period of time, but caused was a kind of literary success of a kind that is incomprehensible if one considers the turgid prose in which the book is written. The negative terms are always authoritarian, hierarchical, and passive. Postmodernity, as Etzioni envisages that period, holds out the hope of expanding individual freedom. Quote, "The typical members of postmodern society are fragmented among several not fully coordinated collectivities, but these affiliations increase the autonomy of members. Suburban neighborhoods provide an expressive base for political clubs, friendship groups for political cells or cliques in political organization, the family for societal knowledge and consciousness, which are elements of political education." Etzioni, who relishes the prospect of a socially fragmented but politically ebullient postmodern age, treats the naysayers with condescension. Mocking traditionalist laments about family values, he notes that what they really see, quote, "is a process not of disintegration, but of decolonization and transformation being applied to the family," unquote. Its members, quote, "are being rendered functional for their new expressive possibilities," unquote. Etzioni views high divorce rates as additional grounds for optimism. The modernized family finds a parallel in religious and ethnic groups, whose members change their identification with increasing frequency. Quote, "For all of these units, a smaller stress on ascription is an accommodation to increased vertical horizontal mobility, which modernization requires and fosters, and to the greater capacity for members to change their affiliations to those with more compatible units," unquote. The above passages exemplify the inexcusably cumbersome but also deceitful jargon into which modernization theorists usually slip. Pages won't come apart. The disintegration of family ceases to be seen as problematic as soon as a sociologist stresses the need for decolonizing children or for functional expressiveness. Ethical and social breakdown means emancipating mankind from cohesive collectivities and for allowing them to interface with more compatible units. The pseudo-scientific terms employed not only blunt what Burke called the moral imagination, but permit Etzioni to associate extended metaphor and daydreaming with rigorous scientific procedure. He and Dahrendorf, who seeks to save the German people from their illiberal past, both identify politicization with human self-realization, but neither one should be mistaken for a latter-day Aristotelian. The political practice Aristotle praised originated within established communities, among family heads, and the bearers of a distinctly Greek philosophical culture. Political life, properly understood, aimed at raising all the members of a polity toward the ideal of justice. Yet this ideal was to be pursued by socially and functionally differentiated people, who even while politically unified, remained parts of family and tribal groups. By contrast, Etzioni and Dahrendorf's politicization is total and capricious. Neither one recognizes the claims upon modern society of pre-modern social institutions. Both repeatedly ridicule any perceived nostalgia for organic social ties. Dahrendorf portentously reminds his reader of the Nazis' appeal to traditional agrarian communities. Modern men are supposed to take their bearings from modernity itself. Yet what are the binding social values of a modern culture that both men praise partly for being antiseptically removed from the past? Or put a bit differently, how can non-cohesive collectivities be made to hang together? For Etzioni, the proposed solution is to get everyone constantly involved in approved political causes without the hindrance of traditional social obligations. Dahrendorf proposes the same kind of transformation while engaging in righteous hand-wringing over the German people's non-liberal past. His comments about this past contain a kernel of truth overlaid with much polemical husk. The Nazi catastrophe might understandably occasion the view that there was something radically wrong with Germany for at least 100 years, or as Dahrendorf puts it, the Germans lived in a faulted society. Unfortunately, many historians who address this question explain not what may have led to January 1933, but why the non-enactment of their laundry list of reforms inescapably resulted in Hitlerism. Most of Dahrendorf's historical observations about Germans as unmodern men in a modern world would indicate his membership in the latter group. Although this judgment seems ultimately defensible, there is a pleasant surprise in his work. In the last section, he examines the Nazi phenomenon with remarkable insight. He shows that a movement that often appealed to agrarian values actually pursued economic and administrative modernization. He properly stresses the electoral and moral support that the Nazis received from public workers and bureaucrats, both of which, and civil servants and public workers, groups which responded to a movement that called for a larger, more powerful German state. But although Dahrendorf adopts Friedrich Hayek's term constitution of liberty, he rejects a truly liberal as well as any traditionalist view of good government. What he wants, quote, is a revolution to modernity, which may be summed up in a single word, citizen, and which consists of a defense of liberty and equal citizenship. Citizenship rights, however, are to include, quote, equal rights to a minimum income which secures the social subsistence level of everybody, unquote. Having provided this point of entry into the welfare state, Dahrendorf then constructs a Teutonic equivalent of an argument for affirmative action. Pre-Nazi German society allowed disabilities to be inflicted on Jews, Slavs, and women. Of these three alleged victims of historical discrimination, women, the only one of the three groups not specifically singled out by Hitler for destruction, are the ones whose fate the author most loudly bewails. Dahrendorf calls upon the school system, quote, to change attitudes toward women and traditional, harmful traditional values, unquote. Germans should be systematically re-educated not to identify women with home and family. Moreover, Dahrendorf praises the East German practice of granting privileged access to educational institutions to the progeny of working class families. This practice is aimed at removing what for him is a troublesome obstacle to modernization, economic inequality. Any theorist who tries to prove that a gradual blurring of class lines has indeed occurred in post-war Germany gets scolded, quote, for catering to a frightened government class, unquote. What Dahrendorf really objects to, in my opinion, having had to read his book as a graduate student, having had to suffer through every word of it, is modernity as opposed to post-modernity. And despite his attacks against the Prussian aristocracy, the most recurrent object of his attack is not aristocratic manners, but any non-engineered society. The non-engineered society he confronted in 1967 still permitted sexual roles, family loyalties, and at least traces of 19th and early 20th century bourgeois attitudes about women's responsibilities. Such anachronism seemed to trouble him far more than the Nazis, whom in fact he discusses quite dispassionately. He wishes to root out what he calls the German ideology and to replace it with the liberal theory of government, that is, the contractual basis of all society provides the starting point and hope of development toward the greater happiness of the greatest number. Presumably the only political dogma that liberal educators will be allowed to teach is based on a purely quantitative and atomistic definition of society. Educators will be obligated to make their countrymen more enthusiastic about public affairs. According to Dahrendorf, Germans do not enjoy politics sufficiently. The German is unpolitical, he writes, because the political is deeply unimportant for him. He's authoritarian because he would really prefer not to be drawn out of the freedom of his four walls, unquote. To save Germans, quote, from the syndrome of ritual participation, private virtue, authoritarian consequence, unquote, Dahrendorf apparently advocates a policy of compulsory participation, non-private virtues, and authoritarian consequences. In short, a hard tyranny to match Etzioni's tyranny by persuasion. There can be non-utopian and balanced theories of modernization, as the works of Max Weber and of others should reveal, but defective and aberrant theorizing also thrives. Social analysis often yields to fantasy and ultimately theurgic art, although the sociologist or social historian continues to speak about science, even while practicing what Eric Fergelin appropriately styled alchemy, attempted total reconstructions of reality intended to adapt the world to the intellectual's private vision. These alchemical reconstructions, sometimes presented as the essence of modernization, require for their success one of two political preconditions. In Tocqueville's phrase, soft tyranny or hard tyranny, social pressure and re-education will be the first means applied to gain support for the desired form of modernization. What will then follow, if necessary, can be easily discovered by even a cursory reading of Orwell's 1984. Thank you.